how I persuaded my father to take his personal collection of American European economic history into the Hillman Library. And now let me tell you about the Spoken Record Library Fund called the Sidney and Sadie Stark Spoken Record Library. But when you go into the Hillman Library in the University of Pittsburgh campus, off of the park entrance, up the stairs, on the left-hand side is a rather sizable room called the Stark Listening Center. And that is a room that has well over 2,000 titles of the spoken record as a teaching tool. It started out with me giving the library $17 and then getting the idea of persuading my brother Carl and Sidney Stark Jr. to join me, and we each put $500 a year into a pot until we were able to get up to $10,000 so that we could endow this spoken record collection. Then simultaneously, my father, back in the early 50s, had established two funds at the Pittsburgh Foundation, one for the ophthalmic research at Montefiore Hospital, honoring Dr. Harvey Thorpe, who incidentally saved this right eye of mine from a chorioretinitis, until such time as the Montefiore Hospital, affiliated with the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, at which time he wanted his money back, and for the money to be donated to the University of Pittsburgh Library. So that $7,500 ended up in our collection. And then he also, back in the early 50s, created a $15,000 fund in favor of the YMHA, as he knew it in his lifetime in Pittsburgh, until such time as it merged with the Irene Kaufman settlement and lost its objectives as he knew them, in which case he wanted that money to be also turned over to the University of Pittsburgh Library. So that $22,000 added to our 10, and I said to my brothers, let's keep it going, we'll get up to 30, and we got to 30, and we went for 50, and before you know it, we had $65,000, which is the amount of the present endowment of the Stark Listening Center at the Hillman Library. Strangely enough, I said to them, you do the bricks and mortar, and you do the machines, and I'll provide the guts so that if and when you have to change the tapes or go to some other form of technology, you'll have the money to do it. But I found that satisfactory, and so now they're in the process of setting this up in such a way that a kid can sit in his room and press a telephone and get the tape put on the machine and get to listen to Shakespeare or get to listen to Theodore Bacall doing Fiddler on the Roof. And as you've said, you have heard it, it's got exciting
music.
That's exciting because it's just such a great concept. Of course, Carnegie has an incredible collection of music. And my thought initially was not to involve music until Pitt started to grant the PhD in music, and particularly in jazz, and so now it's got a significant jazz collection and other forms of records. But when you start to think of human knowledge and the fact that a university provides a PhD in jazz, you've got to believe that the musicians in my family would be thrilled with that idea all the way around, including my parents who never studied and didn't know how to play, but surely they provide us with the opportunities. Anyhow, the library then now has that Sidney and Sadie Stark collection of American European economic history with a 20,000 endowment that I'm sure must be a lot more. I'll tell you, an interesting,
we'll all be dead one of these days.
Yeah, well, an interesting story about that library fund. I used to ask for annual reports of what they were doing, and each year they weren't spending all the money they were earning. And so I finally said, hey, come on, what goes on here? We just leave it roll until next year somebody will spend it. But I said, it looks to me, all the years I've been watching it, that you never spend it. What happens is the university gives you last year's amount plus 4%. So that they always build the corpus and why this $65,000 is now $120,000, and they point with pride. The other thing is that when they discovered that Fosbar had this mortgage on the farm, that he had used library funds, I said to the university people back in 1987, what happens to this money that you don't use? Oh, that gets swept into the chancellor's account.
I said, you can't do that. I want that money put back into the capital account. Well, you have to send us a special letter on that. So I finally sent them a letter and said, do me a favor. When you don't spend all the money, do me a favor. Add it to the corpus so that down the road we'll have an even larger library fund in case you decide to branch out into some other form of service. Incidentally, the University of Pittsburgh grants a PhD in library information sciences so that the library is tied in at Bradford and at Johnstown and at Greensburg. And someday I'm sure that these records are going to be available for that purpose, which would be just great for everybody. I'm trying to convince them to move the American European Economic History program over into the business school where Zoffer would love to have it. The closest they came is they moved it into the fourth quadrangle to make room at the Hillman for other things, which is good because that's only across the street, and Zoffer can't be too upset about that. But it's exciting because it just shows you what a little bit of money will do properly invested. And it set me off to setting up a library fund in honor of a friend of mine, 65th birthday at the Milton Eisenhower Library in Johns Hopkins, and that got my friend giving money to Hopkins, which he didn't want to do, but he's now got $1 million salted away, so I know he'll be able to do that. And just last week, I mailed 100 volumes to Oglala, O-G-L-A-L-A, Lakota, L-A-K-O-T-A, Oglala Lakota College on an Indian reservation in Pyle, South Dakota. I gave them $100 last year to build a clinic. The closest one to a doctor is 90 miles away, so I figured they'd be with a clinic. And sure enough, I found out that I got on the list for Indians. So here was this two-year college in Valdosta, South Dakota. I said, by God, they can use books. So I told some friends of mine, and I went out and I collected 100 books. It cost me $58 to mail them last Thursday, but some of the books were on economics, on Karl Marx, on statistics. One of my friends had a marvelous collection of books that when she took her master's degree. And so I said to them, and I wrote them a letter to them, and I told them that when they acknowledge this, they might just tell these people that they're going to make a shelf in their name, because these people will keep sending them books and money, and this Indian college will hopefully come into the 20th century. I was a trustee at Point Park College since 1964. That's, I think, 36 years.
What's the name of the...
Let me tell you a story about Point Park. After I finished this University of Pittsburgh thing, besides the library and the two collections, I was on the alumni council for 3 years, but that had no history for me because it was a bunch of people crossing T's and dotting I's, and I had too many other fish to fry. I got involved with the religious education department because there's a harmless guy around town by the name of Alex Orbach, who's now the head of that department. And before that, a guy by the name of Goldstein, and they were offering a program in Hebrew and one in Yiddish, and I figured, well, I might as well help them because it's library and information sciences, and somebody's going to benefit from it, and particularly as to Yiddish, which back in the 40s, my father started to make us send $25 a year to the Yiddish Scientific Institute because he said, you mark my word, this Yiddish is going to come back and be an important factor in the survival of Jews around the world. And you're talking now 50 years ago in the 40s. And here we are with the Russians coming over here and Yiddish being a very important factor in them communicating in the Pittsburgh community, let alone New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, Philadelphia, Boston, and so forth. So in the meantime, what happens is I got on another list, I love to call it my soccer list, for a fellow by the name of Aaron Lansky, who managed to salvage 1 million volumes of Yiddish
yes.
in 1987, 88, and 89. And of course, in 1990, he won a MacArthur Fellowship for $225,000. And theirs are given in the blind because they, MacArthur's didn't want to know where the money goes. And so Lansky bought a van, and he took 8,000 volumes on a boat and got off in Poland and loaded the van and went from small town in Russia in 1991, distributing 8,000 volumes of Yiddish because it's still being used in the small shtetls of Russia around what used to be Leningrad is now St. Petersburg. And so the Yiddish Scientific Institute was in Vilna. Half of their library got to the United States in New York, which I've been supporting all these years along with my dear brother, and half of it was still in Lithuania. So when he went back this time, by God, a huge portion of that library is still extant, so us Yiddishists survived that, that program in Lithuania too, and joined the two libraries at some point or another. So all of this from my father's insistence that the future of civilization turned on people knowing how to read.
That's right.
There's a great program going on at the Homewood Library here. Two Jewish women have a program called Begin with Books. So I send them $25 a year. And what do? They give six books to little children before their fourth birthday in order to teach them how to read in their own homes in the ghettos. Then, of course, Bill Block of the Post-Gazette has a son who graduated from Allegheny College and came to Pittsburgh, didn't even want anybody to know who he was, and he's the guy that's in charge of the literary fund that is now teaching people how to read. 35,000 people in Allegheny County can't read. So I send them one.
Very good. You know, I'm a little surprised you mentioned the name Auerbach and Borstein. I'm surprised you know them. How do you happen?
Well, for the reason that in the process of setting up, being interested in the university, and I began to develop some interest in religious studies. There was a girl that was here taking a PhD in religious studies. When I found out about Clothe, C-L-O-T-H-E-Y, the head of the religious education department at Pitt was doing, I said, geez, I've got to help this guy. I was trying to get him, they're putting out a quarterly annals at Pitt on superstition. Of all the things in the world that you wonder about, would there ever be a need for a discipline called superstition? And here they are putting out a quarterly book. I don't know if you know how these things work, but they publish compilations of articles from various colleges and universities, and you'd be amazed at the number of schools that are offering this particular course of study. And of course, the book is being planned, edited, and published out of Pittsburgh. So I tried to help them. Pitt accepted the first Catholic chair in 1991 from Marus, the chairman of the board of directors. And that was an interesting story because I went to hear
Marus?
M-A-R-O-U-S.
Yeah. Westinghouse.
Yeah, your boss at Westinghouse. So what happened was I went to hear the presentation by the head of the religious education department at the University of Virginia coming to describe what Pitt should look for as they try to fill that chair. And the man that was involved, there were only about 35 people, there were three priests from Central from St. Paul's and a couple of other people that I could recognize. But by God, it was an exciting experience because this fellow was a deep rock Jesuit and he was head of the religious education department at the University of Virginia. And he said, gentlemen, whatever you do, don't hire a Jesuit in this chair. Because Jesuits historically look backwards. Get a secular Catholic out of a secular university who will help you plan forward-looking research on the position of Catholics and the meaning of Catholicism and its purposes and its objective and its future. And I thought that was a fascinating concept. Because anybody that knows the history of Jesuits, and believe me, my ignorance is exaggeratedly large. The only thing you can remember about Jesuits is they always managed to look backwards, and they were the most dangerous people in the intellectual firmament because of their restricted vision on most subjects. And I have to stop there because I don't even know any more about them than that. But I know I have this visceral feeling based on my ignorance. Hope I don't offend anybody. I really don't.
Well, you're not
going to
worry about
the Jesuits. No, the key is that it was so I'm still in the process. Now, Orbach's on a sabbatical this year because
right.
I'm trying to persuade him to use the Israel Heritage Room as a conduit for expanding the religious studies programs to try to get these Jews who are upset with Pozbar, that don't want to support the university, to put their money into the Israel Heritage Room around the treasury. Now we have $10,000 stashed away over and above what we need to send two people to Israel. Two that we sent this year were fascinating. One was an Orthodox priest who's taking a PhD at Pittsburgh Theological, and his objective was to study the status of the Orthodox in Jerusalem. And he had a fantastic story. He's going all over the city talking about how great Israel is and how great Jerusalem is. The other woman, the other candidate, was a woman who had spent 3 months in the Israel Army. I think she was Christian. And she went back to do an anthropological master's degree comparing the women in the American Army with women in the Israeli Army. And so what I'm saying is there are many, many reasons why people will give money to the Israel Heritage Group. I want to use some of it to bring Christian young people to see the room and end up with Rose Shulam at the Botanical Garden showing the plants of Israel and feed them punch and cookies and enhance their understanding of Judaism and the interfaith meanings. And incidentally, this to me is one of the attractions of the Jewish group, that I feel that if we can do something to break down the barriers among people, one more time you won't need priests and rabbis to lead you by the nose to tell you what to think and how to go. You make your own judgments and people are people. Now this is one of the strange things about my 55 years of fundraising for the Federation, that I could never buy the Israel First and Foremost ones. I call Senator Specter a single-issue person as far as Jews are concerned. Because all he knows is Israel, Israel. I don't know Israel. I want to save Israel because it's a bunch of human beings, decent, kind, intelligent, trying to make a better world. The fact that they belong to some church doesn't interest me. The fact that there are Arabs that are trying to kill them, that does interest me, because it's people trying to kill people, not because they have titles. So that in my world, there would be an absence of color and an absence of titles, veneration of the differences between the sections. But I still like to live in the door and treat ladies like ladies. I don't mind them aspiring to be equal to men. I think that's very mostly. But there comes a time when grace has to come into play, going in both directions. I think this is the toughest part about being married.
Yeah.
I think that's about the survivors. Then as far as the university is concerned, I pulled together now for 3 years in a row people from the classes of 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38 for an annual convocation at lunch to just go back and reminisce about what was and what can be, of people who think philosophically like I do, but now the rhetoricians. Rhetoric is the way you... I was a debate manager. They were debate managers and getting these people and other things at the university, but we have a commonality of interest in building a better world. One of them was the mayor of Palm Springs, another one was Genevieve Blatt, the Supreme Court Justice of Pennsylvania, and people, and Leonard Martins, who was head of the first head of COMSAT and the head of USIS, Joe Katz's friend from DeWitty Street. So, you mean, I bring these people together and hopefully some good of that. Nate Davis, I'm trying to arrange a gift for Nate Davis of some old music of a friend of mine who has probably a $7,000 collection of woodwind instrument music that should be put somewhere.
Yeah, you mentioned Davis. Wasn't there a Davis jeweler downtown?
Oh, yes, Jacob Davis.
Jacob Davis.
His whole family, yeah.
Do you know anything about it?
Oh, extremely much. I was involved with it. I want to tell you that story because at the age of 60, I went back into the jewelry business. And the name of my company was Goldstock. I took it over for 3 years and wanted to find out what it was all about, so I could sell it to the previous owners. And I had a wonderful time. My life enjoyed it tremendously. And so it's still expanding. The only difference is now I have 400 square feet and three employees now. My wife said there were 12 feet yesterday there. They have 12 employees and 1,000 square feet doing things. It was a good business, and I'll tell you about that. I didn't want to tell you about
something.
I represent the scholarship at Point Clark College in the Playhouse. I'm going to tell you that.
Okay, you write it down.